more than we would ever want to admit, the truth that is that our culture is influencing our understanding of the Bible. Let me give you an example, and there's a point to this. It's highlighted, by the way, in a wonderful book on biblical interpretation entitled Grasping God's Word. For a lot of people, depending, of course, upon their age, when they read the book of Jonah and think about, as they think about how that scene appeared to unfold, they might visualize Jonah inside the belly of what they would say is a whale, in the midst of a circular-shaped stomach about 6 to 8 feet in diameter with just a little bit of water at the bottom. Well, I've never been in the belly of a great fish, but I don't think that's what it looks like at all. Where did this image originate? As the writers of the aforementioned book note, they believe, and I would agree, it likely came from the book or the movie Pinocchio. Remember in the movie, a whale swallowed the main character, Pinocchio, and there's a scene where he is sitting inside the whale, and it's a sort of barrel-shaped room on its side, 6 to 8 feet in diameter. That's what many people see in their mind as they read the book of Jonah. For those who have read the book or seen the movie Pinocchio, when they read the book of Jonah, they begin a search of their memory, probably subconsciously, looking for a picture to visualize this event. Their mind comes to the Pinocchio scene, and they automatically begin to fill in the blanks of the description of the Jonah story with information that comes from a Hollywood movie. Just as one example, the book of Jonah never says he's swallowed by a great whale. It just says a great fish. To the point, as Grasping God's Word records, we find ourselves, quote, influenced in our reading of the Bible without even realizing what has happened, end quote. Now, I'm going to address this notion again next week with a little different angle, so act surprised next week, okay? For our purposes today, when we read about David and Goliath, too much of what we contemplate is either what we've seen in some cartoon or we've heard a well-meaning, albeit potentially misguided, preacher say. My point is, don't read into the text. Don't read into the biblical text. Let the Bible speak for itself. Don't make it something it's not. So I know we've all heard sermons about how Goliath represents the giants in your life. No, he doesn't. Goliath represented the Philistines. That was it. And while, of course, there will be some inferences we can draw about Goliath as an enemy of God, the main thrust of the story is not about you and whatever proverbial giants you're going to face in your life anyway. Seeing it that way is like seeing Jonah seated next to Pinocchio in the belly of a whale. Well, I feel better with that out of the way. So let's read together as we continue our series, Snapshots of Sovereignty. We're going verse by verse through 1 Samuel, and we find ourselves this morning in the 17th chapter, and we'll begin our reading with the first verse. I'll invite you to stand, please, for the reading of God's Word. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socoh and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them. Thank you so much. You may be seated. We'll get to more of the text momentarily. But there are four main thoughts that I would have you to recognize this morning from the text. Number one, the battle lines will always be drawn. We get this from these first three verses that we just read. The battle lines will always be drawn. The two groups will meet at a particular valley known as Elah. This is an important place due to its significance militarily as well as economically, we're told. So the two armies are on either side of the valley. There's a stream that marks the boundary between their two camps. There's really nothing earth-shaking to report about any of this yet at this point. The text is straightforward and sort of speaks for itself. I suppose as I read it again this past week, I was simply reminded that this type of scenario has always been and will always be part of humanity until Jesus returns. Battle lines will always be drawn. Now, I'm not like a lot of pastors in this regard. I know you're thinking, you're not like any pastor that I know, Ken. But let me simply say, military prowess, understanding various strategies for war and so forth, that's out of reach for me. I've read a few books on World War I and World War II. I've seen a few movies about various wars in American history, but frankly, trying to explain the finer points of the skirmish between Russia and Ukraine, or even the United States and Iran, that's not on my immediate to-do list. It's not that I don't care. It's just that I don't understand it. It's kind of above my pay grade. I don't have a strategy. So all that to say, battle lines being drawn, wars being fought, shedding blood and dealing with atrocities, it's all been part of the landscape ever since history began. And other than recognize it and point it out, I don't know really what else to do with it at this point. But I do have one prediction that I want to share. Here it is. My prediction is that battles, wars, skirmishes, unrest, warfare, fighting, and so forth will continue on earth until the Prince of Peace, that is Jesus, returns. We've all likely heard the saying, there are two certainties in life, death and taxes. I would say there are three, death, taxes, and war. So the battle lines will always be drawn. Secondly, the enemy of God's people will often appear large. Look with me, please, now as we pick up in verse 4. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. The enemy of God's people will always appear large. What happens next is really not very typical. Goliath comes out from the camp of the Philistines. He's going to now challenge the Israelites. And don't miss this. He's a big man. I mean, he's a really big guy. 6 cubits and a span would be about 9 feet, 9 inches tall, give or take a bit. Not that it would matter at that point. The Septuagint, however, which is a Greek version of the Hebrew Old Testament from the 2nd and 3rd centuries B.C., says 4 cubits and a span, which would be 6 feet, 9 inches. In either case, Goliath of Gath is a force to be reckoned with, as they say. Goliath has superior equipment as well. A bronze helmet was not the norm for the Philistines. His coat of mail is pieces of metal that were set atop one another. They're overlapping. It's basically body armor, and it weighed about 120 pounds. He has bronze armor on his legs, a javelin, a spear, and a shield bearer as well. Goliath's weapons and his armor were intimidating enough. Imagine seeing all of that. That would be intimidating enough. Scholars note he likely would not have been very agile at all at this point due to the size and the weight of his equipment. I suspect he wasn't all that worried about that. Anyway, he probably didn't think the battle would last very long. He thought he would win and win quickly. Now, I want to tread lightly here because I know this point might be a cause for someone to become easily offended. I don't know if you know this or not, but today people become easily offended. The tendency, in part at least of the narrative, is to spiritualize the text and to talk about the size of the giants we who are striving to lead righteous lives might face. And I get that. I do believe God's people have had to face an awful lot of challenges through the centuries. And the truth is, brothers and sisters, that's not going to change. But the main concept of the text is not about anybody really facing their giants. It's really about the Israelites and one loud-mouthed hulk of a man by the name of Goliath. Having said that, it is safe to say that figuratively and literally, it's important to note that the enemy of God's people will often appear large, sometimes even larger than life itself. Why is that the case? Intimidation, among other things. The enemy of God is always seeking to scare, always seeking to intimidate. We've all likely heard the saying, the pen is mightier than the sword. And that's true, unless someone is holding a sword on you. I guarantee the Israelites that day would much rather have seen Goliath of Gath emerge with a pen in hand as opposed to with a sword. If Goliath had come out to battle looking like a toy poodle, nobody would have been afraid, right? So what does he do? He comes out as decked out for battle as he possibly could be. He wants to put fear, he wants to strike fear into the hearts of the Israelites, and he does. Typically, the enemies of God's people will appear large, but don't give in to fear. Don't give in to fear. Don't give in to despair, no matter how big or powerful your enemy might appear. Several years ago, if you had said that Roe v. Wade would be overturned the way that it was, it's very likely a lot of people would have said, man, there's no way. Not after all, there's no way that's going to happen. It's too big of a deal. And I know, by the way, what we're still facing in terms of the pro-life movement. We still have battles before us. There are several states in the United States that have gone the way of making allowance for abortion up until the point of birth. God help us. Massachusetts, most recently. And the money that backs all of that wickedness is astronomical. But listen, God can overcome all of that, don't you think? God can overcome all of that. Whatever the big deal is that we're ever up against, I want you to know God really can work miracles. Still, God can work miracles. Ray Stedman in Authentic Christianity tells how an alcoholic became a believer and was asked how he could possibly believe all the nonsense in the Bible about the miracles. You don't believe that Jesus changed the water into wine, do you? Someone asked. I sure do, he said, because in our house, Jesus changed the whiskey into furniture too. The battle lines will always be drawn. The enemy of God's people will often appear large. Number three, the taunting from God's enemy will usually sound ominous. We pick up with verse 8. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you are not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." The taunting from God's enemy will usually sound ominous. Literally, Goliath doesn't say, "Am I not a Philistine?" He says, "Am I not the Philistine?" He's saying, "He is the one present to represent all the rest. I'm the man," in other words. And what does he do? He taunts the Israelites. He speaks in disparaging fashion against his opponents by calling them servants, which at times can mean slaves, and he doesn't give them any kind of national identity either. So Goliath explains what scholars refer to as representative combat. He's saying, "If I win, then you will become our slaves." And while he doesn't win, we recognize the Philistines will renege on their proposal and flee. Listen, I know how bullies operate. You do too, whether you're a kid in the schoolyard or you're an adult reading what a keyboard warrior is saying about you, I know it can sound and feel ominous at times. They work to instill fear in our heart. That's certainly what Goliath did. But in the end, Goliath, in true bully fashion, wasn't nearly as tough as he purported to be. So the battle lines will be drawn. The enemy of God's people will often appear large. The taunting from God's enemy will usually sound ominous. Fourthly and finally, the response of God's people will sometimes be disappointing. Verse 10, and the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. The response of God's people will sometimes be disappointing. I defy the ranks of Israel, Goliath says. He uses the same kind of psychological techniques that people have been using, I suspect, since the beginning of time. The sadness here, however, is less about the people of Israel, in my estimation, and more about the king, King Saul. Saul is so out of touch with the people, and he is seemingly so far away from God that he doesn't see how this could ever turn out in their favor. He's the leader of the people of God, and his confidence is gone. This would have been the moment for Saul, more than anybody else, to stand up and say, let's go, let's fight, let's stand against the evil ones. But like the rest, even like Goliath was essentially saying, they all believed that brute force was what would determine the outcome. But I want you to notice what did not happen. Did you catch what was missing from the battle plan? Nobody, Saul included, nobody prayed. Nobody prayed. So what's the takeaway? The takeaway is that the people, beginning with Saul, should have stood. They should have stood for God. They should have stood against Goliath. History, sadly, is replete with Christians missing the mark, dropping the ball, and going AWOL when they should have been standing for righteousness on the front lines of the battle. Eric Metaxas said it this way, and this is so powerful, I think. He writes, the parallels to how Germany got to where it was in the rise of the Nazis to where we are now is extremely dramatic. The excuses church leaders gave for their silence in the 30s are precisely the same excuses many church leaders are giving today. God expects his church to be the conscience of the state. I'm going to say that again. God expects his church to be the conscience of the state. He expects believers to stand against the madness. So what do? Begin by repenting of sin and surrendering to Jesus. That's the most important part. Secondly, make that public by being baptized. Thirdly, read the Bible and pray. I'm amazed, saddened, in fact, at how many people don't do this or don't do this much. Fourthly, commit to stand for Jesus and the ways of God no matter what others may think or say. Number five, stand for righteousness. Not just generally, but specifically. Stand for biblical truth about gender, the sanctity of marriage, the sanctity of life, racism, ageism, sexism, abuse, all those things. Keep growing in your faith so that when things get tough, you can, as the Apostle Paul reminds us, you can stand. Stand. Number six, don't be content to remain as a person of faith who doesn't, at appropriate times, let others know what you believe. Number seven, don't give in to despair, fear, indifference, or evil. In other words, Stand. Stand. G.K. Chesterton said, "There are an infinity of angles at which one falls, only one at which one stands."